Bridgebank helps breakthrough ideas actually break through and remains dedicated to providing financial solutions to the risk takers, the game changers, and the disruptors. Bridgebank, a division of Western Alliance Bank. Bridgebank, be bold, venture wisely.
From KQED.
Sometimes I'll be driving around the Bay Area and I'll just see these huge empty lots or just really big sections of land that have nothing on it. And I'll think to myself, why can't we just put more housing there? Like, I know it's more complicated than that, but now that's the question that some of the richest landowners in the Bay Area are being asked.
I think the local communities, especially in the Silicon Valley, are saying, we want you to do more. You have to do more.
So check out Stanford. It's got more than 8,000 acres across two counties, almost $20 billion worth of land value. So should a school like Stanford, which is not in the business of development, start to chip in a lot more? I'm Devin Katayama. Welcome to the Bay.
We're in the midst of an unprecedented housing crisis. It is affecting everybody and everything. It's affecting the quality of our community as a region. It's affecting the livelihoods of the people who live here or used to live here until recently. And the people who have the money and have the land have the power to direct that conversation, or at least nudge it in a direction.
Rachel Miro is senior editor of KQED's Silicon Valley Desk. She and a group of reporters from across Bay Area newsrooms looked at a bunch of data from the Santa Clara County Assessor's Office, and they created this reporting project.
The overarching question became, who owns Silicon Valley?
So we know that Silicon Valley may include a lot of different types of cities and counties, but for the purposes of this project, the group limited their search to Santa Clara County, home to some of the biggest players in the region, like Apple, Google, and Stanford. I know Stanford's got a big campus, but give me a sense of how big Stanford actually is.
We actually did map it, and you look at the visual, and it's just this giant chunk of land. And, you know, I should mention, it really straddles the borders of Santa Clara and San Mateo counties.
You can drive for miles and still be on Stanford land.
I paid a visit to Steve Steiger, who's a historian with the Palo Alto Historical Association, and we got out a paper map. Remember those? You know, he talks about the fact that it is just so hard to get your mind around it because it's so much more than, you know, the iconic campus
right.
that we think of, you know, with the palm trees and
all the buildings.
Grass lawns and the Romanesque-inspired sandstone buildings.
I mean, it's got a golf course. It's got a nature preserve. So this yellow is the Stanford Linear Accelerator, which is operated by the federal government, but it's on Stanford land.
It's huge, and there are 34,000 people in its community, counting students, grad students, postdoc, faculty, service workers. This is a big place, and Stanford has continued to grow beyond the original land grant. It is an empire.
When reporters looked at 2018 records for who had the most property value in the county, Apple had $9 billion worth, Google $7.5 billion, Stanford had almost $20 billion worth of land. How did it get so big?
Well, we'll start with the original land deed, which came, I should mention, from, you know, Leland Stanford, the one who built the western portion of America's first transcontinental railroad, and as a result became fabulously wealthy, and like so many of his ilk, needed not just a mansion in San Francisco's Nob Hill neighborhood, but of course a country estate south of the city. Grew grapes, raised horses, and collected over the years lots and lots of land. Tragedy befalls his family when his teenage son dies of typhoid fever while on a trip to Italy. And this got Leland and his wife thinking, you know, what could we do in our son's honor that would leave a beautiful legacy? And they started to think about, you know, either first contributing to a university, and then how about let's start a university. Let's just do it.
In 1885, they donated land to create the university. But there was this one stipulation. The land could never be sold. But for decades, Stanford was basically out in the boonies. It wasn't this attractive place like it seems now. So it was hard to attract faculty and students. Then, after the post-war period, an electrical engineer named Fred Terman laid the foundation for a technological revolution to come.
One of Terman's interesting characteristics was that he was very nurturing of the students who came through his classes. And he did a lot to really sort of move the critical mass for technology companies away from the East Coast to the West Coast. And thus was born Silicon Valley.
And so we sort of worked together with them, really helping each other develop and grow.
Courtesy of the Palo Alto Historical Association. The interviewer, Jane Morgan, is talking to Fred Terman, and she's bringing up in 1969, there are people, locals, complaining about the explosive growth in the region.
We hear sometimes that we are being overcome, the charm of the city of Palo Alto is being lost. What would you say to this?
Well, there are certainly lots of complaints about things and objections to changes. If they came here 5 or 8 or 10 years ago, they like it that way, and they're perfectly content. And the fact that each new group of, you might say, immigrants that come here and settle down in Palo Alto like the town the way it was when they arrived, even if they only arrived fairly recently, means that it can't all be bad.
If they were having that conversation in 1969, do we actually know when jobs really started outgrowing the pace of housing? I mean, it sounds like it was almost happening back then.
It was happening back then. And that's why I want you to hear from Lenny Siegel, who was a Mountain View City Councilman and then mayor, and now he's a housing advocate, and he's writing a book about the region.
About the 60s, I dug out a flyer from 1968 about how Palo Alto had more than twice as many jobs as employed residents. So it's gotten worse because we've had this unprecedented employment growth and very little housing development.
People have been talking about this as a problem impacting the community currently for many, many years. But of course, it's just in the last 5 to 10 that we've seen this huge revolutionary change in how it has impacted pretty much everybody making less than 6 figures.
Every single person that goes to Stanford needs a place to live. Rachel says Stanford has always housed most of its undergrads and even some of its postgrads. The university also leases homes to faculty at below market rate prices. But Stanford can't house everybody. And for those who can't get help, they're like the rest of us, trying to figure out how much they can spend for a place to live and where that's going to be.
This isn't something that has met the needs of 100% of its faculty, and that's where we get to the current conflict with Santa Clara County supervisors.
The question at hand today is not whether Stanford is a good school. It's about who gets to reap the benefits of development and who has to bear the cost.
Stanford's not done growing. The school's latest expansion plan proposed adding an additional 3.5 million square feet over the next 15 years. And part of that growth would mean the school expects more than 9,000 more students, faculty, and staff. Santa Clara County supervisors are in charge of signing off on that plan. And for the first time ever, the county is saying, hey, Stanford, you need to also provide housing to all these people, which is 4 times the amount the university wanted to provide. This is something Stanford has never been asked to do before.
This is a shift in perspective, a shift in demand coming from the local community saying, whoa, the way you've been approaching it all these decades up till now, not going to work anymore. Their response is, this isn't a negotiation. We're laying down the terms. You choose.
That's thousands of units. How would they even do that? What would that look like?
Well, you know, they have an endowment of $30 billion.
So they're not short on cash.
And they have a lot of land, so they're not short on land. It's not like they have to purchase the land to make it happen. And we're not just talking the foothills. They have a lot of land in the flat part of the peninsula.
Just as supervisors were getting ready to vote on Stanford's expansion plan last Friday, news broke.
Days before supervisors were expected to take up a vote on the general use permit plan, Stanford pulled out. And now it's completely unclear. We don't know, you know, will they pick up the application process again? If so, do they start from zero? Do they have to start with something completely fresh? Or can we pick up where the conversation left off? A lot of this is just up in the air.
Rachel says Stanford's been pretty tight-lipped about why they pulled out. But she says the county's asking the university to take on roles that it hasn't had to take on, like more housing, better traffic plans, and that there's definitely some hesitation from the university over that. What do you think this conversation that we're having about Stanford says about how we're starting to kind of reframe who's responsible for fixing the housing crisis?
Well, as we've been talking, you know, it's pretty clear that we now think of these large landowners in Silicon Valley as needing to do more than just spectate. They need to be active participants in addressing what is, after all, a community crisis. I don't think anybody blames them entirely. There are a lot of different factors that play into this crisis. You know, local zoning rules bear a lot of the responsibility. Proposition 13, there's a long history there of all kinds of frustrating and inequitable impacts. So nobody blames Stanford or Google or Apple entirely. It's simply unfair. But on the flip side, I think the local communities, especially in the Silicon Valley, are saying, we want you to do more. You have to do more.
So this is where it gets really interesting, because now we're asking ourselves this question in the Bay Area, who's responsible for building housing? And I wonder if the conversation's changed about who is responsible, or we're looking to people who are organizations or companies who we haven't looked to in the past.
You know, if you're Stanford or you're Google or Apple, you know, we educate students, we write software, we produce fabulous, you know, gadgets. That's our job. Your job, community, is to deal with the housing piece of it. Zoning decisions, that property development decisions were between private developers and local and regional governments. That's how it works. It was a very rational way to think for a very long time. It's only recently that I think these organizations have felt a certain kind of, at the very least, PR pressure to look like they care, like they give a damn about what's happening around them.
Rachel Miro is senior editor of KQED's Silicon Valley Desk. Rachel says that one of the goals of the project looking into who owns Silicon Valley is really to have everybody think about their role in the housing crisis, especially those who have the land and really who have the power to make a difference. Also, I just wanted to mention that the last episode on the Arinda shooting got a lot of you talking, and that's really what we hope the show does. So please keep these conversations going. You can always hit us up on Twitter. We're at TheBayKQED. Or you could send us an email. We are thebay@kqed.org. The Bay was produced this week by Erica Cruz Guevara, Marisol Medina Cadena, and Julia Scott. KQED's leadership team includes Julie Kane, Vinny Tong, Ethan Lindsay, and Holly Kernan. I'm Devin Katayama. Just a quick note that we are taking Monday off, but we'll be back with you on Wednesday.
Do you ever wonder what it's like to live alone, hidden in the woods, not speaking to a single soul for 30 years? Or wander the desert, uncover a hidden well, and dive to the bottom of the deepest water hole for 2,000 miles? The Snap Judgment Podcast takes you there with amazing stories told by the people who live them, with an original soundscape that drops you directly into their shoes. Snap Judgment. Listen and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Did you ever wonder what it's like to live alone, hidden in the woods, not speaking to a single soul for 30 years? Or wander the desert, uncover a hidden well, and dive to the bottom of the deepest water hole for 2,000 miles? The Snap Judgment Podcast takes you there with amazing stories told by the people who live them, with an original soundscape that drops you directly into their shoes. Snap Judgment. Listen and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.